World Affairs Report, 30 minutes of conversation designed to make you better aware of the world around you. The World Affairs Report is brought to you by the World Affairs Council of Pittsburgh in cooperation with KQV News Radio. The World Affairs Council is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that has been bringing the world to Pittsburgh for over 80 years. To learn more about the council and upcoming events, please visit worldpittsburgh.org. And now, the World Affairs Report.
Welcome, everyone. I'm your host, Angelica Ocampo, and today I'm very pleased to have a very select group of guests who represent a larger group who's visiting Pittsburgh to learn more about leadership and about the city and just gain more professional experience. I'm talking about the Mandela Fellows that are in Pittsburgh right now. My guests today are Dr. Joseph DeCrosta, who's the Director of International Programs at Duquesne University, the university that is hosting the Mandela Fellows. And we also have two fellows, Masedi Tata Kewamodimo from Botswana and Sofwa Petronella Sampa from Zambia. Welcome everyone to the show.
Thank you for having us.
So we have a lot to cover. I'm going to start with you, Dr. DeCrosta. Can you give us an overview about the Mandela Fellows program?
Absolutely. So this is the second year that Duquesne University has been awarded the grant to host the Mandela Washington Fellowship. We're very proud and honored to have this grant. So we have been asked to design a six-week program under the idea of civic leadership. So there are three tracks. Well, actually four tracks that the Mandela Fellowship hosts, one being civic leadership, the others public management, business and entrepreneurship, and a small track dedicated to energy issues. So we were awarded the grant to design an institute on civic leadership. So over the 6 weeks, we focus on different themes that have to do with community development issues, health, gender issues, as well as how religion interacts with these issues of community development and civic engagement. So we've partnered with many organizations across the city that are working on these issues exactly for Pittsburgh, and expose the fellows to these types of ideas and see how it interacts with their own work at home and how we might be able to learn from each other on these different subjects. So the first phase of our program really focused on leadership theory and practice. So different themes of leadership like crisis management, mindful leadership, these types of things. And then we really go into the practical phases and looking at these different themes that I mentioned and how they can apply these ideas of leadership in community development and whatever areas they're working in. So for example, our two fellows that are with us here today are mainly concerned with HIV issues in their home countries and trying to advocate for the rights of HIV, and they'll tell you a little bit more about that, but for the rights of HIV persons, but also how that interacts with their local communities and how can they better lead those efforts to make things work better. But of course, we're learning a ton from them as well.
I'm sure and you are.
Yeah.
And we're so lucky to have them. Yeah. But you were sharing before the show, this is a very highly competitive program.
Yes.
So how are people selected and how many apply to
the program? So this is the fourth year of the program. I guess I should mention that this was started by the Obama administration in an effort to work in African development in a different way, to really create dialogue with our African fellows in every sense of the word, and create ongoing relationships as opposed to just trying to go in and develop in terms of infrastructure and different types of in and out sort of development. So this is the fourth year of the program. This year, 67,000 applicants applied to the Mandela Washington Fellowship, and 1,000 are selected.
Wow.
And we're honored to have 25 of those 1,000 here at Duquesne. The rest of the 1,000 are at other institutions throughout the United States that all host 25.
And this is representing how many countries in Africa?
It's all of sub-Saharan Africa. We have 20 represented here at Duquesne alone. Mm-hmm. So sometimes, depending on the numbers from the countries, we may get two or three from one country, but for the most part, people come, we only have one person from each country. Mm-hmm. I think some of the larger countries include Nigeria, Zimbabwe, and perhaps, those are the two largest that I can think of at the mm-hmm. moment. I guess I should also mention that this program falls under the YALI initiative. So that stands for the Young African Leaders Initiative. So this is really just one piece of that initiative, mm-hmm. the Mandela Washington Fellowship. But when they get back home, they have access to funds and grants to help them with their efforts, as well as a whole network that exists throughout the continent so they can connect to other people that are doing similar work than they're doing at home, as well as continue to connect with people in the States to brainstorm and think strategically about some of their efforts at home.
Well, congratulations to you both for being selected and
thank you.
Receiving this fellowship. It seems really like, they've picked the best of the best. So congratulations to both
thank
of you.
Thank you.
So why don't we start with you sharing a little bit about each of you. Why don't we start with you, Nsofwa? You're from Zambia.
Yes.
And you're an HIV advocate.
Yes, I am.
Tell us a bit about you.
My name's Nsofwa Petronella Sampa, as mentioned earlier. I'm 25 years old, I'm a Zambian, and I'm visually impaired, or rather blind. I was not born with my blindness. I acquired my disability because of lack of adherence. I was born with HIV, and I had problems adjusting. I lost my mom when I was 10, and it led to me not understanding. And then after I lost my mom, I found out I was HIV positive. Nobody told me in the family, not even a health practitioner told me. I had gone to the hospital that day and I was reading through my file and I discovered I was HIV positive. And I was with my uncle and he noticed there was something wrong with me, but he didn't ask me what was wrong. And no one in the family wanted to tell me that I was HIV positive. But then when I turned 15, when I was in a boarding school, a friend of mine asked me what I was taking, and they said, are you on ARVs? And I said, I got upset and I threw away the medication. And at that point, my family knew that I knew about my condition. Still, nobody came to me. So I had a problem with no one coming out and telling me about it, because I was struggling. Because at that time, I didn't understand that HIV could be gotten through mother-to-child transmission. I only thought it can be gotten through promiscuity. And I was 10. Mm-hmm. So it didn't make sense for me to have HIV. So I continued having problems and I started getting a lot of diseases. I had tuberculosis, and then I later on had pneumonia. Then I had meningitis, which led to the loss of my sight. After losing my sight, I discovered I had a chance in life to still move on. And I later started advocating for people living with HIV, AIDS, and people living with blindness, because I'm trying to avoid people living with HIV to not adhere to their medication and later end up like me or dead. Because in Zambia, we have a high number of adolescents that are not actually controlling their medication, who are on ARVs. We have a high number of that. So yeah, that's practically what led to me starting to be an advocate for HIV and people living with blindness, because I know that the community might be small, but we are all infected. They say if you're not infected, you're at least affected.
Well, thank you for sharing that very powerful story. And I'd like to learn more about you in a minute and ask you, what has the role of education been for you to become such a strong woman? But before we go there, Sedi, can you share a little bit about your life story? You're from Botswana. Yes. What is the HIV situation there?
Like I said, my name is Masedi Thata Kewamudimu. I am from the beautiful Botswana. I am 22 going on 23. And for me, I was born with HIV. I lost my parents to AIDS at the age of 5. That is when I got to see how the epidemic was really hitting our country hard. At the time, I did not know why my parents passed away. But when I was at the age of 10, I was also discovered that I'm living with HIV. Now, before then, I had also lost an aunt to AIDS as well. So me finding out that I'm HIV positive a few months after losing somebody who was like a second mother to me, it was confusing to me. I don't really understand what was happening because I had now lost, I had become a double orphan because first I lost my biological parents and then now I lost somebody that was becoming like a mother to me. When I found out, it was very confusing. I didn't know what it meant because what I knew on the street is when you have AIDS, that's it with you. You are doomed, you are destined for death. But I am glad that I held on as much as I could until at the age of 13 when I was fed up, because life of taking a pill is not as easy as it is perceived to be. But I am glad that I was able to get the help that I needed. I was able to get the, to go through the help that I needed, even though it was not the proper help that I needed at the time, but it was enough for me to pull through. It was until I went to university that I got to see that stigma, it is still there. Because even in my family, HIV is not an issue that we talk about. How I'm coping or what is happening is not an issue that is easily talked about in my family. And when I got to the city, I got to see that people talk about HIV as if people living with HIV cannot amount to anything. And that pushed me to want to make a difference. And that's when I started doing my advocacy work, because I could notice that there are a lot of people in my country who are living with HIV. Out of a population of 2.2 million, more than 400,000 are living with HIV.
400,000?
Yes. And right now we're at a point whereby the new incidences are low, but our prevalence rate is 1.35. We have it under control, but my concern was that we have a population that are already living with HIV. If we have controlled the disease, what about those people now? Are we saying that now the disease is under control, we're just going to be giving them pills and forgetting that they need psychosocial support? And that is where my work started at, because I also face challenges that sometimes I don't even have the area of where I can get the help of it from. You understand? And I was trying to help other people in my same situation, because I believe until we realize that it's important to give psychosocial support, we'll not go anywhere as the world. Yeah.
Again, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you.
Are both your countries representative of how vast the epidemic has been in Africa and as a region? Do you think the region is making the same progress that it seems that both your countries are?
On my side, I think we are still fighting with it, because I recently just found out that we have like about over a million people who are living with HIV, and our prevalence rate is about 12%, which is not good as far as I'm concerned, because we still have new infections, over 6,000 people getting infected each day. And
each day?
People... like each day, like I remember I was doing this project and they were telling us that every hour, three people are getting infected, two girls and a guy. Meaning adolescents, youths are not actually using the right means. And even those that are HIV positive are still a number, they are still reinfecting one another. Because we, in Zambia, we never had, there was a time when we were doing fine, but as at now, I don't think we're doing fine because we still have people that are getting infected every hour. So how many people in a day are we getting with the HIV? So the HIV pandemic in Zambia is, as much as we are doing fine, I don't think we are actually doing fine. The statistics are showing that we still have a long way to go, because if we can have 6,000 people getting infected every after, in every year we're getting over 6,000 people infected. I remember last year we had the VCT month, and percentage of just one city was about 75, just one city, meaning people, there's something that we're not doing right. Because even the 90-90-90 goes, we have people that were testing, yes, but how many people are adhering to the medication? How many people are still not doing the right things? Mm-hmm. We still have a number of them, and it's killing us, and it's not helping, especially us, the youths, because most youths don't understand. We have people that will tell you, they'll answer you and say, at least there's medication. But what's the impact of the medication? It led to Sofa losing her sight because of lack of adherence, you see? So I wish, or if there was a way that people could get it in their heads that it's not about just being HIV positive, it's more of the psychological problem. Because HIV has really led to most people, we've lost a lot of people, we've lost a number of us. None of us are here because of HIV. And if we can try and reduce those numbers, like for instance the percentage is at 12, maybe we can get to Botswana, which is at 1, it'll be better. Because I don't see why we should be at 12% in this day and age, when we have medication, when we have all the right things to use, but we still have high numbers. Because I'm thinking 6,000, that's a lot of people, and it's not helping.
And do you think what do you think the biggest challenge is in your case in Zambia? Is it lack of awareness, or is it disregard, or is it lack of adherence to the use of medication, or the lack of psychological support?
The lack of psychological support is one of them. The lack of trying to understand why they're on medication. People are willing to test. That's one thing I know. Because even when you go into the field and go and test, I volunteer at the clinic back home. We normally do field work. So we go out there and you find some people who even come to you and come and test. But most of the numbers that are high on Zambia are the youths. Because most youths, like in schools, we have people that are breaking out of school because of getting pregnant. And even, I remember last year we had 990 people that dropped out of school. And out of those 990, half of those were found with HIV, meaning people are not using they're not using protection when having sex. Mm-hmm. There's no the rates of people for somebody to drop out of school, meaning what are they doing that is not right? What are the parents doing? What is the community doing? What is the headmaster? What is the teacher saying to the students for them to start thinking of having sex whilst in school? So there's somewhere where we're not doing something right. So I think it's not just the adherence, it's not just the psychological problem, but I think it starts from the grassroots, because what are we as parents, what are we telling our children, what are we not doing right? Because I think it's even the people who are, like for instance, people that are already HIV positive don't want to disclose to their partners that, oh look, I'm like this, so we can't do this. So they would rather just go ahead, sleep with somebody without using condoms and reinfect the person, thinking, oh, or we have people that will say we are both HIV positive, but then HIV has got stages. There's it changes as time goes on. It's not the same HIV we had when it came. Mm-hmm. It has changed. Mm-hmm. So we really can't say because I have that HIV, then I'll be okay. Like I can give an example of myself. I'm HIV on the second line. I'm taking second line medication, so I have HIV 2. If somebody, I sleep with somebody who's got HIV 1, I'll reinfect them. So we'll reinfect each other because I can't take the medication that I was taking before because I resisted to it. So people need to understand that. It's not just because you have HIV and my partner has HIV, then things will be okay. It's not like that.
Is that something that is understood in general by the youth? Is it like disregard to that kind of information, or is it lack of knowledge?
I think it's lack of information also, because even when they go for, I think maybe we're not preaching the right, we're not telling them the right things, because we just tell them about the risks of how it can be prevented. We don't tell them about the psychological problem. For instance, if somebody comes for VCT, you tell them about how HIV is contracted, how it can be prevented. Say that person is found with HIV today. There's no psychological, you know, it's difficult to just start taking medication. The first thing that the nurse or health practitioner will do is send them to the other department where they have to start to be enrolled. What if that person is not even ready to be enrolled, you see? So there's no psychological support. It's not something, it's not like you've been told you've got malaria. You know that there's going to be coartin you take and you'll get better. It's HIV and there's no cure. And even just the way HIV came, it didn't come it's not, it had titles, you know, like AIDS, the killer disease, and things like that. Everybody has got all those traumas about HIV. Mm-hmm. And it has taken a lot of people to understand. It takes a lot, like, to just understand. It took me, 17 years and losing my sight to understand that HIV is just a virus. Mm-hmm. So imagine somebody who doesn't even know that. Mm-hmm. So I think there's lack of information.
Mm-hmm. A lot of work to be done.
Yes, there's still a lot to be done.
Sedi, tell us a bit more about the situation in Botswana. Do you share the same kind of diagnosis that Sofwa has just made? And I'm curious also about the social stigma that is related to having HIV.
One thing that I'm proud of about Botswana is that our third president, Mr. Festus Khontebane Mokae, he fought the epidemic beyond anything. Because like I'm saying, right now we are at a prevalence of 1.35. That means that we have really fought the HIV epidemic. But now here's my problem. Recently, about 2 years back, we launched Treat All, which aims at everybody who is newly infected that enrolled on treatment. And what we have noticed is that when you're on treatment, there's less chance of you infecting the next person. So that is what the government has been trying to use as well. But also, like she mentioned earlier, that people forget that HIV is not as easy as putting somebody in medication. There's also the psychosocial support of it. And what we have noticed, or what rather so many people have noticed, even I included, is that the children who were born with HIV in the 90s now are young adults who are struggling to accept and understand what it means to live with HIV. Because HIV is so difficult to live with, and because even in relationships it makes it difficult, these young people are not able to cope with the situation. They're resorting to alcohol, they're resorting to unprotected sex, because now they are the cohort that are rather spreading the virus, what we're seeing in my country. Because, like I mentioned earlier, we have fought it, we have people on treatment, and we are trying as much as possible to educate people, but we are forgetting that the 400 that are already infected, what are we doing for them? And that is the major problem that we're having. And that is why, even though we are at 1.35 as the entire nation, the youth are around 24%. Mm-hmm. And that means that these are the people who have been living with HIV and who have been on treatment. But now, because life stages are changing and that nobody is saying anything or nobody is helping them, preparing them for that stages, it makes it difficult. And another thing that makes it difficult, it is the discrimination that is there in my country. When you say I'm HIV positive, it is as if I said I have Ebola, because Ebola is airborne, and people don't understand that. And that is why most people would rather not disclose in a relationship, and this leads to unprotected sex. Unprotected sex with alcohol, and you're not virally suppressed, that leads to now the virus spreading. And we're also seeing this with elderly men who are sleeping with young girls and who are in universities. So we have a problem of young people who are not employed, they resort to prostitution, and elderly men who are leaving their families to come and sleep with these young kids. And some of those young kids are already on treatment, you understand? And this elderly man will be telling you, if we have unprotected sex, I will give you more money. So this girl, she knows that she's been discriminated against. She sees herself as not amounting to anything. So what does she do? She resorts to unprotected sex. And that is a problem we're having in my country. And that is why I've been constantly saying that giving somebody a pill is not the only way to fix the problem. If this person does not know how to cope with the situation, the epidemic will keep on growing, because we are seeing a huge number of people in their early 20s who were born with HIV and who do not have anywhere to go for resources, to go for support. And the places that are already there, they're not functional. You understand? And I believe that it is only until we realize that we have a problem and change that, we can be able to go somewhere. And another thing that I feel my country has a problem on is that they feel we have preached HIV too much and it's enough. Mm-hmm. And like I'm saying, it's enough, yes. HIV, the infections rate is under control, but what about the 400,000? Mm-hmm. Because if we say it's enough and that people still living with it, it is not enough.
And you know, that's what I've learned from these young women is, you know, for someone who's not in the medical field and has a basic knowledge of HIV and growing up during the emergence of HIV and AIDS and all of this, you know the basics, even in this country. But then you don't understand some of these details. And the one thing that they really exposed to me was sort of the psychosocial impact on what they're experiencing every day. Yes, their virus may be under control with the meds and they can live a full life in many, many ways, but there's all of this discrimination against what they can do, people misunderstanding the disease. Mm-hmm. They told me it's not a disease, it's a virus.
Yes.
You know, so things like this that I've learned.
The social stigma,
the stigma that exists is just so pervading in their countries, and even I think in the United States to a certain effect, that I think that the work that they're doing and trying to expose their fellow country people to these ideas is really important, so they can get a control mm-hmm. of the spread of this virus.
Well, to me, it's so moving to hear both your stories, who are very hard personally, but at the same time, I'm seeing two very strong women, very accomplished women, who
Absolutely.
Are also giving back so much to the community in Africa, but also here right now in Pittsburgh. You're mm-hmm. lighting us and the audience.
Yes.
So I want to thank you for that and commend you for that, and also ask you, where does that strength come in your own lives? Because you're sharing the stories that are very tragic, yet here you are, and you have a great future ahead of you. What was it that made you, you know, come ahead?
Personally for me, I believe, first of all, when I lost my parents and my aunt to AIDS, they became a statistic. And I believe those statistics drove change. And me being born with HIV, I was born to become a statistic. And I cannot let myself be a statistic that is just sitting and doing nothing. I lost my parents to AIDS and I had to learn to become an adult at a young age. I had to overcome so many things for me to just be an ordinary person. I believe that even though I still face a lot of things, but I believe that I cannot be born with HIV and sit back. Because at a certain point, I was sitting back waiting for someone to come and help me until I realized that I need to be that change that I need to see in the world. So for me, is trying to make my parents' death have a meaning, them being a statistic have a meaning beyond just them having died to AIDS, and my life also living with HIV to have a meaning as a whole.
Yeah, well, I'm sure they're very proud of you.
Thank you.
For me, it was my sight loss. When I lost my sight, I was not depressed about losing my sight. I thought I was fighting. I had something that was worse. I thought HIV was more than my sight. But after losing my sight and finding out that most of my friends were dying and most of them had problems at hearing, had problems similar to me, and they died and I'm still here, I thought it was worth the fight. And I thought I would be the voice for those that can't speak out, for those that, the blind people that, for instance, are also infected like me and don't know what to do, because I see situations like back in Zambia where somebody can't go and get medication because of they don't have anybody to support them. And here I am, I have like this somebody I can go with, I can go with a cab, I can. I thought it was worth the fight, and I thought if I said something or made a move, somebody out there would be helped. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so my sight, I kind of thank God that I lost it. In the same way, I kind of regret, but I think I'm more happier as I am.
Well, I would say thank God for your resilience.
Yes.
Both of you. So, unfortunately, time is running short, but what do you expect to get out of the Mandela Fellowship, and what are your plans when you go back to your countries? And we have 1 minute, so I'm sorry, but it's all the time we have.
What I'm expecting to take home with me is the hope that I've seen around here. It is what people are doing in Pittsburgh. And what I aim to do when I get back home is to show somebody that is living with HIV that it doesn't matter that you're HIV positive, you have a goal in life, and if you work hard, you can achieve it.
Great.
For me, I want to take back the attitude of saying that blind people can't do anything in their life, because I've been proven wrong when I came to Pittsburgh that actually disability is not inability, and there's more to life than sight. And I believe that I will do something when I get back home. My intentions are actually to go and try and change the mindset of those people who think that blind people can do anything, or a person living with a disability is not able to do anything. And Pittsburgh has actually proven that to me.
And I would just like to say how inspirational both Sadie and Nsofa are. They do not let anything stop them. And I can say that by first person account over the last several weeks. Nsofa riding every single amusement park ride at Kennywood Park here in Pittsburgh, to experiencing everything on the program. And it's such an inspiration. And I think your hope for us here as well. And I think their story is universal in so many ways.
Well, I want to thank all of you for coming here, especially Sadie and Sofwa. Thank you so much for all the work you do, for the, as Dr. Cross said, the inspiration that you are, but especially for how you live with such grace and dignity, all of the adversities that you've already overcome, and people cannot see it, but you're both smiling and just, you know, just taking joy out of life, and that's a true inspiration. So thank you so much for that.
Okay. Thank you. I just wanted to shout out to my friends back in Duquesne that hi Ioness.
Yeah. And at home too, because
and
they
at
can
home, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you want to say goodbye in your own languages?
Yes, well, I wouldn't mind it in English. It's
okay.
Goodbye.
Thank you so much for having us.
No, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for being here. And to our listeners, thank you again for joining us. We'll be with you again next week. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the World Affairs Report, brought to you by the World Affairs Council of Pittsburgh in cooperation with KQV News Radio. The World Affairs Council is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that has been bringing the world to Pittsburgh for over 80 years. To learn more about the council and upcoming events, please visit worldpittsburgh.org. Be with us again next week when we take a 30-minute look at issues of global importance.